So as Cliff mentioned, this is our last lecture, and so I just wanted to recap what we've covered so far and what I hope to achieve in the last hour and a half that we have this morning. So as I emphasized, I really think what I did manage to achieve was the most important part, and that was what was nominally in lectures one and two, but of course that went over into Friday as well. And just to summarize, if you take anything from these lectures, hopefully you have some sense that it really is overwhelmingly compelling that something like dark matter exists. And in particular, we can say that whatever this dark matter is, it makes up 84% of the matter budget at the present epoch in the universe. And where this is coming from, although often people talk about rotation curves and the bullet clusters as these beautiful objects that I think have a very visceral way of understanding them, really this precise measurement actually comes from the CMB, which is a much more precisely measured quantity. From there we took, I mentioned how the various different hypotheses were slowly excluded, and what we've been left with essentially is that whatever this dark matter is that it's something of a particle, although that's in inverted commas as we get up to the very heavy masses. And what I showed you is that there's an enormous landscape over which this particle mass could be, and there's really an enormous range of possibilities even once we've narrowed down the fact that dark matter could be a particle. So of course there's two ways of viewing this. This is, on the one hand, maybe this is slightly overwhelming, the vast range of possibilities, but also there's really an enormous amount of possibilities, because the way that you would search for solar mass dark matter is very different to the way you would search for 10 to the minus 21 EV dark matter. But the other thing to keep in mind, as much as this is a vast range, it's not really the case that anything goes. We do know an enormous amount about dark matter. There's many observations that any theory you come up with have to be consistent with. But despite that, this isn't enough to restrict the range down beyond the enormous one that I showed you already. So in 1 minute, last lecture, I covered the topic of the third lecture I wanted to mention, which was something about WIMPs. And I got generally that there wasn't a lot of excitement about this topic in the room, and that's fair enough. I sort of preempted it that way. But hopefully you got some sense that there, and hopefully if you're not convinced by this and you want to know about dark matter, you'll work through that thermal relic calculation that I mentioned, because there is some reason that our field has focused on WIMPs for roughly 40 years. I appreciate that maybe we've had an overly obsessive focus on that, but it's not that this was a completely unfounded focus. So if you're not convinced by that, I encourage you to at least do that exercise to have a sense for this. So that's what we've done so far. Let me tell you about a little bit what we started doing last time and what we're going to be focusing on today. And this is diving into how you would actually detect this axion, or more generally what I have in mind here is to give you some flavor for how you would detect this wave dark matter.
Nice drawing. Nice drawing.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. This is the benefit of coming in early. I can coordinate my colors. Thank you. So, but you've seen this already. So this was what we started talking about last time, that we started discussing how the cosmology would look like for these axions. It's going to be somewhat different to this sort of thermal cosmology where the particles come out of the thermal plasma, which is where we think the Standard Model emerges from, for instance. So what I wanted to do today is finish this off, tell you about one of the reasons we're so excited about axions. This is the notion of the QCD axion, but I'll tell you about that extremely briefly and point you elsewhere. Because where I really hopefully want to spend at least 45 minutes of my time is actually talking about how you would detect this thing. Because it's so different to this notion of particles coming through an instrument and scattering off. What sort of ideas could we actually use to probe this? And I think this is an area where there's still a lot of active thinking going, and I find it very, very interesting. So just, I got from some of the questions I got after last lecture, as nice as my drawings might have been, I think the physical explanations that went with them were somewhat confusing, I got from some of the questions I had afterwards. So just briefly to review this, but after this I'll actually put some equations on this to hopefully give you some more intuition. So the picture was that this axion is a Goldstone boson, or technically it has to be a pseudo-Goldstone boson because we know it must have mass of its dark matter, associated with some broken symmetry. And the way that we imagine this happening in the early universe is that early on the symmetry isn't broken, so this particle is just sitting at the minimum here. Then as the universe cools down at some point, for example as you might go through the electroweak phase transition, there is a phase transition, and what this means is that there's this degenerate minima, the fluctuations of which are associated with some massless Goldstone, and just by spontaneous symmetry breaking the axion ends up at some random point on this circle that I've placed here. But then of course, because we know for it to be dark matter it has to have mass, this picture cannot be exactly correct. And so we have to correct this and say that the potential is slightly tilted, because if it was literally degenerate, then this particle would be exactly massless, and then it would be a terrible dark matter candidate. So this mass has to enter at some point and the potential gets tilted. What I want to do next is add some equations to this to try and make this slightly more quantitative what's going on. But again, unfortunately, due to my choice of how to divide my time, I won't go through all of this in detail. So there's another very interesting question that I'm happy to talk about offline, which is, when is this occurring? If you remember earlier on, I gave you this picture of question mark, question mark, question mark, and then BBN occurred. Well, there's a lot of things that could have happened in the early universe. And one of them, for example, we think is that there was this epoch of inflation. And it turns out exactly how the axion cosmology develops will depend critically on whether this symmetry breaking occurred before or after inflation. But let me just leave you. You need to keep that in the back of your mind if you're working on this, but I won't be diving into that here. So let's just try and make this picture slightly more detailed. So in particular, let's try and understand how this particle associated with the fluctuations around this minima here would evolve in an FRW universe or an expanding background. Good. So I won't derive this here, but you can show that the value associated with this axion field will experience a friction-like term associated with the expansion of the universe. And then also it will be oscillating because it has a mass. So this is the equation that you would end up needing to solve to understand how this axion field value is evolving. And let's just pull some basic facts out of this. So if we're working at early times where the value of the Hubble parameter is much larger than the mass of the axion, then what you can convince yourself is that at those times, this final term is going to be negligible, and we can just focus on these first two here. But then this is a particularly simple problem to solve. If we take out that final term, you can see that if I just take the axion to be a constant value, then this is going to solve this equation here, right? Because the derivatives will kill everything off, and we'll get zero. So indeed, the picture that you have is that at these early times, when the mass isn't relevant, essentially the Hubble friction just freezes the value of the axion. And because this has dimensions, the value that it's frozen to is associated with whatever random angle you ended up fixing to here. This is this theta naught that I've called it here, but it's just some angle. And then the scale associated with this, because this has mass dimension and this is just an angle, the only other scale in the problem to make up the dimensions at this stage is this FA scale, wherever the symmetry breaking occurred. So initially, the picture is that there's no oscillations. The field is just fixed at this random value which you broke to. So this is the picture to have in mind when we're up at this stage here. But then eventually, as the universe cools down, we won't be able to ignore this parameter forever. And you... Please, yes. Unbelievable. Yeah, great. Very, very good point. Yeah. So for here, and this often happens in this literature. Thank you for asking this. Yeah. I should have mentioned that at the start. I'll call R the scale factor. It's common in the axion literature because A is pretty usually kept for the axion. But it's extremely confusing. I agree with that. So thank you for clarifying here. Yeah, so A is the value of the axion. And then, for example, when we look at the Hubble constant, the way we're going to be defining that is in terms of R in particular. Thank you.
Okay, so what do you mean the value of axion? It's energy density or something?
I mean it's some scale of field. So I'm roughly just keeping track of it. For example, here, I'm imagining the axion I'm thinking about as like the angular component of this scalar field associated with the symmetry breaking. And so here it's just fixed, it's fallen down to whatever value is that it had for spontaneous symmetry breaking. But eventually, and that's at early times, but what you can imagine is going to happen is that once the mass becomes relevant, it's going to notice that it's not at the minimum, and it's going to be energetically driven to fall down. And that's the case we'll deal with in a second. Please.
So I'm a bit confused here why the solution of that equation is not an exponential. So is H is not a constant, or I don't know, there's something I'm missing here.
Ah, good. So I think this is potentially related. H doesn't depend on A, H depends on R.
Right.
So this is definitely true that there's a, if I set this equal to a constant, then the derivative of a constant is zero, and the second derivative of that is also zero. So this is definitely a solution to that equation, right?
Right, but it's not...
Please.
Yeah, it's not the general solution. Like, it's not, because the general solution would be an exponential if you solve that, because you'd get like,
I think what we're going to see, well, what we're going to see next when we add this additional part in is that you do need the exponential part of this.
Okay.
But in order to keep, that's a fair point. But in order to keep track, I mean, also you have in the back of your mind the physical picture of the evolution that we have going on here. And I do expect this roughly to be fixed. But this is, I mean, ultimately what you need to do is not solve this with the approximations. And that's what we'll do in a moment. And you're seeing there is this exponential feature here. But in the limit where this is the case, that solution will roughly behave like a constant. So we're going to solve the more general case in a second here. Thanks.
The exponential is going to describe how fast you approach the constant, right? It's going to be the, if you started with some initial velocity, it'll just tell you how long the transient took.
Ah, good. Yeah. And so this is something that people worry about in axions as well. And I think in the situation I'm imagining here, I'm having this thing start with zero initial velocity. But in principle, that's another case you need to worry about. And another modification of the cosmology that people put in, which is exactly what Cliff is saying, is adding this velocity. So I think that's what you're touching on there. Great point. Good. So the next thing I wanted to say is, what happens if we have to solve this in general? Well, you can do that.
What are the initial conditions? Sorry.
I mean, the initial condition is I'm imagining that this thing is just sitting. I'm taking to study the situation starting here. It's just sitting at rest at some minimum. Now, as Cliff was alluding to, you can potentially have this thing start at some velocity. And you need to keep track of that. So it'll be you need to keep track of that. But I'm not going to go through that in this simple picture here. Please. Yeah.
Are the time derivatives in the informal time or the coordinate time?
In here, I believe I'm keeping track of it in the coordinate time, but I think you need to be careful about that. If anyone knows that I'm mistaken with that, please let me know. But I think I'm keeping track of this just in the coordinate time. Good. So what I want next is to keep track of what happens when the Hubble constant is much smaller than that, so that I can no longer throw away this final term here. Now, if I could completely neglect this, then it's a very simple equation to solve. You're just going to have some cosine oscillating at the a frequency controlled by the mass of the axion, okay? So this is sort of what we had at this picture at the end of last time, that when you're talking about wave-like dark matter, that is roughly how you think about this oscillating wave. But we know that the expansion of the universe must play some role, so let's not completely throw this term out. Let's just imagine to begin with that it's, in the case we're going here, that it's now just much smaller than this one, so that we're not completely throwing it out. So to put this together, so if we had this, then the solution that we would have is that there'd be some constant, but otherwise this thing would just be oscillating at the mass plus some random phase. But that's not what we want to do. We want to imagine that this is some small perturbation that is slowly changing this picture here. I mean, this has to be the dominant picture because that's the dominant part of what's going on. But if you think about taking a WKB type of solution to this, what this is going to do is slowly change the value of the amplitude that we have here, okay? So I won't go through this calculation. I left it as an exercise, mainly just to save myself some time, but also to keep you involved in this. So then the idea is you take an ansatz, which is that this amplitude here is actually varying. And what I wanted you to check is that if you substitute this into the equation up here, and because this is WKB, you imagine that this isn't changing too rapidly compared to the other timescales in the problem. What you will find is that the way that this amplitude is varying is it's evolving with this scale factor, which was correctly noted earlier on, to the -3/2. So it's essentially getting redshifted at this funny factor of r⁻³/2. So why is that interesting, or why am I going through this? Well, there was another exercise I gave you in an early lecture which said that if you have this wave-like dark matter, you can confirm that the energy density in the system is proportional to the field value squared, right? I asked you to work through this. This was in order, remember that we saw that the prefactor for the axion was like a square root of the energy density, and I asked you to check that. So this tells us the energy density goes as the prefactor squared. And so that means here, if I substitute this result in, the prefactor of this result here is going as r to the minus 3. And that's interesting because that's exactly what cold dark matter would do. Or essentially how matter redshifts. So this is, it's a slightly different type of thing. We have some field that is oscillating about the minimum here, going backwards and forwards. But then if you actually go through and solve the equations, you find that the way that the energy density in that system redshifts is just like if it was matter. So maybe this is slightly counterintuitive, but this tells you that if you have this particle born in this mechanism, even if it's extremely light, it can still be a cold dark matter component. Whereas if, for example, if this was thermally produced, there's no way that that would be the case. It would be born extremely hot and wouldn't be consistent with what we have observed from large-scale structure, for instance. So from, I mean, this is just one statement that it works. The other thing you, of course, need to go through is do a detailed calculation, putting all the factors in, and determine for some initial misalignment angle you have, which is wherever you fell in this minimum, what is the actual energy density in this system, and can it be compatible with the observed value of this dark matter energy density that we have in the universe for valid parameters here. And what you can do in like this Marsh axion cosmology reference I showed you, they go through this calculation, and it's a useful one to go through if you're interested. And you can show that this is satisfied, but ultimately the values that you need to choose in order to get this, I mean, they're sort of arbitrary. There's no, you know, it's not necessarily what you would have predicted a priori. So it's one that you can go through, it can work, but I don't think it gives us a very deep explanation maybe for why this 0.84 comes out. Please.
So we... spontaneous symmetry break, right? And then axion is just the radial excitation, right?
So not the radial, it's the angular excitation.
The angular excitation.
Because that's the one, so it's a pseudo-Golisson boson. So if there wasn't some mass effect, so the picture here is that we know that because it's a Golisson boson, most of the way that the axion couple is going to be derivatively to make sure that the shift is protected. But then for it to be dark matter, I'll give you one way it can get a mass. At some point, it has to have a mass, or it's not dark matter. And indeed, I mean, the way that you write a mass term down, it manifestly breaks the shift symmetry here. But yeah, so it's the angular excitations of this broken symmetry, but then it's a pseudo-Golisson boson, I mean, similar to the pions, for example, in the standard model.
And you tell the potential by temperature, or what do you do?
For this, I'm evolving this by temperature. Yeah, so I mean, similar, I mean, maybe some of you haven't, but if you have, for example, thought about electroweak phase transition, the way that we think that happened in the early universe is you started out with a potential like this, and then as the parameters evolve under temperature, eventually there isn't a deeper minimum, and the field is, I mean, either there'll be some gap and you'll need some first order phase transition, or otherwise it's just more of a smooth transition. Regardless, eventually you end up at some new minimum in this problem, and then later on you notice you have a mass once the Hubble parameter is comparable to the mass of the axion, and then these oscillations tend to begin. Now, of course, the oscillations are always there, they're just not dominant until, or really relevant until later on.
And because the tilt is small, sorry.
No, please.
Yeah. Small, you neglect radial excitation, right? Because it's
there. The radial excitations are there, but they'll be of order, I mean, essentially the mass of the radial excitations will be this FA scale. And so that is there, but in an EFT sense, you can integrate that out. These we'll see in a moment that FA, for these sorts of models, you imagine being like 10 to the 15 GeV, like at the gut scale, or very, very high, 10 to the 10 to 10 to the 15, whereas MA is going to be very much smaller than an EV. So there's a huge hierarchy of scales, which means there are those excitations there, but you integrate them out. Good question. Yeah. Sorry, there's a question over here first. Yeah.
Is there a reason, is there like, say, maybe some explanation for like a mechanism that would cause, like you said, it's like as you turn up the temperature, like, you know, that you would get this tilt.
So
it's all like, you know, is it all in the same direction, or are they all randomly tilting in different?
No, this tilt here,
yeah,
do you mean?
No,
as soon as you have it, good. So this is, I think part of what is happening here is that there's quite a rich story that's going on, and I'm giving you a very abridged picture of it. And of course, as you drive into the details, I haven't told you everything. But I think one of the questions that people were asking me yesterday is, where does this tilt come from? The point is, at some level, this particle must have a mass, or it could never collapse to form structures and be dark matter. So we know it must have a mass. Now, where did this mass come from? I'll tell you briefly when we discuss the QCD axion, one mechanism for generating it a mass. But there are others. It could, I mean, maybe the Lagrangian of nature just has a bare mass for this particle in here. Or when people talk about axions emerging from string theory, there are other mechanisms that give it a mass. It has to have a mass somehow. We know that. But given it has a mass, this picture that this is a perfectly degenerate set of minima here must be incorrect. because that's associated with fluctuations of a purely massless state. So this, we know this picture must be incorrect. And the reason I say this only becomes hold later on is because in the history of the universe, the curvature scale of this potential is set by FA, whereas this tilt here is set by size MA. And because of this enormous hierarchy, you only really notice that it's tilted late in the universe's evolution from the perspective of this picture here. So I'm happy to take your question as well, but just to say, I'm gathering that I don't think this is the most deeply satisfying picture here. I encourage you, if you're really interested in this, to work through this in detail, have a look at this paper. But hopefully the one thing that I just wanted to give a plausibility argument is I think it's counterintuitive that these wave oscillations could at all even redshift or behave at all like cold dark matter. And this is the reason that they can. When you actually calculate how the energy density in the system is redshifting, it does behave like matter, whereas I think a priori that's a bit surprising maybe. Please.
Are there conditions on the fields that contribute to the potential in order to have that process?
I would imagine absolutely yes, but I don't know them off the top of my head. Yeah. No, I mean, there are UV realizations of this. I mean, there are many of them that have been written down, specific models of how this U1PQ came about. Again, I've just chosen not to focus on that here, but there's a very detailed literature on that that it goes through these sorts of questions. Good. So having left you all unsatisfied, let me move on. And just say a few words about the QCD axion. Now, these are all very important points. I just wanted to get to saying some words about how you detect this thing. So this is a choice that I've made. So again, I'm going to leave you with too few details here. I'm going to do the QCD axion briefly. But if you want to see more, I refer to you to a paper called the QCD axion precisely. Yeah. It's a very nice paper that works through all of the details that I'm about to skip over by Cortona and collaborators. I hope I'm spelling that right. Good. So one of the reasons that people are so interested in axions at the moment is that really just solve as much as dark matter is a problem. As particle physicists, we would hope that whatever ends up solving the dark matter problem fits into some larger paradigm that we'd like to describe. So for WIMPs, for a long time, we hope that fitted into our solution to the hierarchy problem. But for axions, their motivation is that they could solve another problem we have in particle physics called the strong CP problem, which I think Brian at least briefly mentioned in his lectures on the standard model. Is that correct? So it was not correct. Okay, very good. So then I will briefly tell you about this. I watched the first 2 minutes of his lectures, and he showed the term associated with the strong CP, but maybe he never discussed it. Very good.
Can I ask you something before?
Of course, yeah.
This special mechanism is, you chose this bit because you want the axion to be bosons. If we wanted to be fermions, we could use similar mechanisms in standard model in track the particle with
heat. So to say, I mean, I think to step back a bit, when we go into what actually happened in the early universe, there are an enormous number of ways that particles can be produced that end up hanging around today and could play the role of dark matter. So I've briefly alluded to two. One of them is that you have particles in equilibrium in this plasma, and then slowly as the universe cools down, some of them go out of equilibrium. This is the sort of thermal cosmology that WIMPs we hope fit into, but they need not. And then this one here is just one other mechanism that bosons can go through, okay? But the reason I'm sort of focusing on this is this thermal mechanism will hideously fail if the particle is extremely light, because you produce it at the temperature of the plasma, and then it only starts to cool down, in particular, once, you know, to non-relativistic speeds, once the temperature of the universe is much, much less than the particle mass. And so it's never going to cool down if the particle has a mass of 10 to the minus 15 EV or something like this. So this is another mechanism people have come up with. This is what is broadly called the misalignment mechanism, where you can produce very light particles that redshift like matter. So it doesn't get killed instantly by these hot constraints. But this is not the only games in town. There are hundreds and hundreds of mechanisms people have come up with. But maybe this and the thermal one are two of the most compelling people have described, is how I would say it, if that helps. Yeah. Good. So here is what Brian should have told you. And I'm sure he had good reasons for not doing so. So fundamentally, the strong CP problem asks, why don't we see the following interaction in the QCD Lagrangian? So there's some convention here, but one way this is commonly written. So essentially, why don't we see a term where there's a contraction between the QCD field strength and its Hodge dual with some arbitrary parameter in front of it, which we call the theta parameter? So, I mean, if you haven't heard about this before, there's a lot I could go into this about why such a term is there. You might think it's a total derivative, but actually there are boundary effects associated with this, meaning that you can't immediately throw it out. I'm happy to describe that, but let me not go into this at the moment. But we do believe such a term should be there in general, and then in the spirit of naturalness, it should just have some order one coefficient associated with it. However, you can go through a calculation and you'll find that such a term induces an electric dipole moment for the neutron, which we can go and measure experimentally. And what we have seen is, famously, we haven't seen a neutron EDM. So the fact that that isn't there tells us that whatever this theta parameter is, it has to, at the moment, be smaller than 10 to the minus 10, which is significantly smaller than 1. And so the strong CP problem is, why is this the case? So as I'll show you in a moment, if you computed this, there's actually some energy density in the system associated with theta being non-zero. So you can imagine if theta was some dynamical parameter, well, then the system would try and drive that down to zero. But theta is just a number. It's not dynamical. But this already hopefully gives you some spirit for what we want to do. If we make this theta dynamical, in particular, if we make it an axion, then the system itself will just dynamically drive this value down to zero to minimize the energy. And that's why we haven't seen anything. But otherwise, a priori, this is a term that could exist and people worry about it. So let me just tell you briefly what happens when you try and solve this for the axion. And the reason I want to do this is that this, although people think more broadly about axions, the parameter space associated with the strong CP one is the one that we often focus on. So a lot of what you'll see in the axion literature is guided by this solution here. Even though I'm being very brief with it, it really is an important part of the story. So in particular, if we try and solve this with an axion, what we imagine doing is we add in, thinking about the axion as an angular mode, although of course it has dimensions, so we have to divide out by FA, we just imagine that there is a similar coupling here. And again, you can write down UV models where this is realized, but let me just imagine that this is the interaction that we have. Well, now what I claim that there's some energy density associated with this. You have to sit down and do that calculation. The fact that this is a total derivative means that you're not going to be able to calculate this in perturbation theory. And in fact, actually what you have to do is you have to use the chiral Lagrangian to actually do this calculation. And you can get a flavor for why I'm just skipping all of this and pointing you to this paper here, the QCD axion precisely. It's a very beautiful calculation that they work through very carefully in this paper here. But I'm just going to quote to you the result that you get for the potential when you have this term and this term here. What you find is that the potential will depend upon the value of the axion. But because this is the chiral Lagrangian, there's features associated with a pion as well. So that is what they got from the calculation. M pi, these are the pion mass and the pion decay constant. Okay. Pion mass and decay constant. So these are the basic parameters associated with describing interactions with pions in the chiral Lagrangian, for example. They set the scales involved. So what you can see now, or if you can check this, is that if you take the argument of this sign to be zero, you'll drive this thing to the minimum. And so then there is actually a dynamical force that's acting on A to sort of push it down to a value where the overall combination of this angle plus the theta angle goes to zero, and this would be how you dynamically explain the strong CP problem. But that's one, I mean, that's just, you can see this immediately from this. But another point is that if I expand this out, assuming that this A is a very small parameter, this A over FA, because as I said, there's going to be you expect there to be quite a hierarchy here. If I expand this out, the better way of saying this is I'm pushing this to the minimum. So if I expand it out around the minimum, at next order, I'm going to find interactions that are of order A squared. And if you have interactions that are order of A squared, then that tells you that this particle has picked up a mass from the same interaction here. So actually, even though I never wrote down like an MA squared A squared, this interaction has given rise to this potential, which ends up giving this particle a mass. So this is one way that this QCD axion gets a mass, but of course it could be a more general axion and the mass could come up other ways, which is why I was being a bit less specific when I was talking about this potential here. So in particular, you can expand this out in Mathematica, for example, and what you'll find squared you'll find this contribution here, and because this is the coefficient of minus a half a squared, this will exactly be the axion mass, a squared. And then you can just look up what values are there. This is the up quark mass, this is the down quark mass. We roughly know what they are. You can put this in, and this quantity here turns out to be roughly 1/4. So if we're looking at the axion mass, this is just a value of a half. And so if we just drop this, as I've been doing throughout, you find that there's the following relationship. That the axion mass times its decay constant is roughly given by the pion mass times its decay constant for the QCD axion, not necessarily more generally. So what this tells us is that we know both of these quantities are order 100 MeV. I mean, hopefully you know that for the pion mass. And if you haven't played with Kolb perturbation theory before, I'm just telling you that's what F pi also roughly is. And I told you I want to have FA to be, I mean, maybe order the gut scale, extremely high. And what we'll find from this is that the axion mass therefore must be extremely light. So in this scenario, for the way you set it up, you generate a mass for this particle and it's extremely small. In particular, just to give you one value that often comes up in plots, we know that wherever this FA is broken, we expect it to be broken below the Planck scale. So what would happen if you put FA roughly m Planck into this? You would find that for the QCD axion, MA has to be bigger than about 10 to the minus 12 EV. So for ultralight dark matter, recall that we said maybe you could go all the way down to 10 to the minus 21 EV. But for the QCD axion, you actually can't have the mass be any lighter than roughly 10 to the minus 12, all the symmetry breaking scale would be above the Planck scale. So often when people are showing plots of the QCD axion, they always cut at about 10 to the minus 12, and it's rarely discussed why, but this is why. It's just coming from that statement here.
Sorry, I was lost.
Please.
Why MAFA and FI if there's this one quark?
Oh, because I threw that away. Yeah. So, I mean, if I kept track of that, it would be 1/2, okay?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I just threw that out. Yeah. No, you're right. Yes, thank you. Yeah.
One quick question.
Of course, yeah.
I might be wrong, but if we assume that the one that was truly massless, it will say that strong symmetry probably
changes. Yes, yeah. No, it's not. It's an extremely insightful comment. And in fact, actually, if you go back and it can be shown that if one of the quarks is massless, there actually is no strong CP problem, because this relates to many of the subtleties that, sadly, given time, I've decided to brush aside. Like, why isn't there an analogous type of strong CP problem for a hypercharge or for SU2? You can actually check that, I mean, these sorts of terms you can move around by doing a chiral rotation, for example. So that they don't just appear like this, they can also appear, for example, in some of the quark couplings. But if one of the particles is exactly massless, you have an additional degree of freedom to move between the left and right components. And actually, you can completely rotate this angle away. And then this whole effect is just not something you need to worry about anymore. So particularly, I mean, one of the consequences of this, for example, is if you try and solve it this way, this thing just disappears. It's not going to be so relevant. So We know quite accurately now, I believe, that, I mean, I think we actually get this from lattice data, that the up quark cannot be massless. I mean, it seems to be inconsistent with what else we know about nuclear interactions. But if the up quark was massless, there actually would be no problem to solve here, for example. So I think you're hinting at something that's actually quite important there. Good. Please.
Right, and the neutrino masses wouldn't screw it up, right? What?
Then you...
That rotation you mentioned just now.
No, because this is just happening in the QCD sector.
Yeah, but I mean, like, if we do the analogous thing for the other groups and so on.
Well, I haven't thought about this before, but it may actually be that at least in the... Let me not commit to this. I mean, in the case of the electroweak sector, because the neutrinos are charged onto that, you do need to worry about this. But what you can show is you have enough degrees of freedom in the electroweak sector that these sorts of angles can be completely rotated away. So I can point you to references on this. Let me not try and reconstruct this off the top of my head. I'll probably just say something confusing. But these are the sorts of things you exactly need to worry about when doing this. Please.
The FA is also related to the decay of the axiom.
It's good. This was the next point I was going to make.
If MA FA needs to be very high.
So what you might, for those of you who started the Carle Lagrangian, what you might be aware of is that F pi is related to controlling the interaction strength of the fields there. And similarly, FA is going to control the interaction strength of what's going on here. And actually, what you end up finding is that not only is MA inversely proportional to FA, this is also roughly the scale of the couplings. So if you make FA higher and higher and higher, you make the interaction that the axion has with the standard model smaller and smaller, which makes it harder and harder to detect, which is, I think, related to what you were saying here. And for example, initially people had hoped that FA might be of order the electroweak scale. These were the initial models that were written down. But then you would have a very strongly, relatively strongly coupled axion, and this was excluded within a few years of experimental measurement. So now because of this, we think that FA should be much, much higher. Good, so this is, in 35 minutes, just a quick overview about why such a particle you could even plausibly think about as being the dark matter of the universe. I mean, firstly, how is it possible that an ultralight particle could essentially redshift the way that matter does, which is what we seem to think that dark matter does, and why would you even care? And the reason you might even care is because this particle could solve the strong CP problem in the way that I've said. However, the UV description of the axion is much, much richer than I'm giving here, and I think has been alluded to in some of the questions. But nonetheless, what I want to do is just take, for instance, that it's motivated such a particle could exist. It could be the dark matter. And then so what we have is at the location of the Earth, this one proton mass per centimeter cubed of dark matter is made up of a huge number of these states that are behaving like some oscillating wave. What I want to turn to in the last hour or so is how would you detect that if it was here at the location of the Earth, okay? So there are many, I mean, the first thing to think about is what standard model states could the axion couple to? I've already given you one. It could couple to a QCD. And if it's solving the strong CP problem, we hope it couples to QCD. However, just to tell you ahead of time, this coupling is very challenging to look for. There are ways of doing it. But one way you can imagine you can search for this, well, such an interaction, I told you, gives rise to a neutron EDM. So if actually the axion is the reason we don't have a strong CP problem, we know that the axion has driven itself to minimize this potential. But then we know it's oscillating around that minimum. So what you would expect is that the neutron does have an EDM. It's just very small, and it's oscillating backwards and forwards. So people have come up with experiments that could search for this, but just to say it's very challenging. But the other thing is, in the sorts of UV models people write down, you try and the axion can interact with other states in the standard model. And for example, one of the ones that people focus on mostly is that we hope that the axion might couple to electromagnetism. And the reason we hope this is, as I'll give you an overview, if such an interaction exists in the Lagrangian of nature, there are many, many ways that it could show up. And in particular, I mean, we're very good at manipulating electromagnetic fields, and so we might be able to see some sort of interaction associated with this. This isn't a completely nuts idea to write down. Actually, for example, in the standard model, we know of a particle that's just like the axion that does couple in this way here, and that's the neutral pion, for example. So, the neutral pion we know can decay to two photons, so it has a similar sort of interaction here, this two-photon vertex. And actually, because the axion's also a pseudoscalar, and it's got a very intimate relationship with the pion here, in these QCD axion models, you end up, just through the mixing with the pion, inducing such a coupling here. So it's certainly not something that is completely unmotivated, but in principle, it doesn't necessarily need to be there. This is something that we're hoping exists. So the other thing that you might remember about FF tilde is that this is just minus 4e dot b. So actually, if I write this out, what you can see is that literally this axion has some interaction with electromagnetic fields we might set up. So one thing to note at the outset is that this term here, this combination here, is dimension 5. And so that means that whatever this coupling constant is that we're trying to search for, it is dimension minus 1. And indeed, related to what I was saying up above here, you can actually check that for the QCD axion, let me call it G instead of GA gamma gamma from now on just to save myself some time. You broadly expect, just from looking at, for example, the mixing with the pion, you broadly expect that the interaction goes as 1 over FA. There's some other factors that come out when you do the calculation, but they're not that large compared to FA. And if I substitute in our relationship between FA and the pions, you find this. And indeed, as you go to lighter masses, you find that the coupling to electromagnetism runs away. So that's the prediction for the QCD axion, but maybe there's axion particles that aren't the QCD axion that have other values of G, for instance. So we can see that this axion couples to E dot B, but in what I'm about to tell you, and essentially the entire axion literature, no one ever talks about trying to detect axions using electric fields. We always talk about searching for axions using magnetic fields. So I just want to briefly tell you why that is, because I think it's not always stated. So why, I'm about to tell you that every effect we look for using this FF tilde interaction is always going to be with magnetic fields. But when I wrote it out, it's E dot B. So why is that? Well, let's look at roughly the largest magnetic fields we've built in a lab. So in all of the examples I'm talking about here, I'm focusing on the idea primarily that we're looking for this on the Earth. So you've probably heard, at least at the LHC, for example, we're able to build magnets that are order 10 Tesla. And what are we able to build for electric fields? Well, I looked this up. I'm not sure this is the exact world record, but largely the largest large-scale electric fields we've made are about 10 kilovolts per centimeter. So which of these is larger? Well, it's not immediately easy to compare these because they're in very different units. But what I can do is I can ultimately convert both of these to natural units. And then in the scale of natural units, we're going to do all of the calculations there, and then we'd boil it back. So let's convert these to natural units. And I can tell you that 10 Tesla is about 2 by 10 to the 3 EV squared, whereas the largest electric fields we've built are about 3 orders of magnitude smaller than that in natural units. And if you want to work in this detection business, you've got to get familiar with doing these sorts of unit conversions. Although I must be honest, I do most of these using Mathematica. I don't have a handy mnemonic for these yet. So what you can see is that the largest electric fields we build up essentially have much less energy density in them, this is what this is saying, than the largest magnetic fields we build up. And some of the intuition is that as we try and build up larger and larger electric fields, they tend to destroy whatever you're building them in. They rip the electrons out and then these materials start to fall apart, whereas we can more stably build large magnetic fields, although there's challenges with this. So broadly, if we want this axion to interact with some large energy density we're doing here to maximize the chances of its conversion, for example, magnetic fields are just generally the way to go, because we can just build up much larger energy densities in them. And so this is why essentially the entire field of axion detection is focused on using magnetic fields.
Oh, and how do we align them in a good way? Because it's also the problem.
It's E dot B, do you mean?
Yeah.
So what this is, I mean, this depends on the specific type of, it's a very good question. It depends on the specific type of interaction you're going through. So I'll mention one in a moment, and depending upon the way that you're trying to exploit this interaction here, that E dot B nature will imprint itself in a specific way. But I mean, not generically, but let me just show you how I'm hoping to exploit this, and you'll get some flavor for this. So if this exists, it turns out there's many, many different ways you could experimentally exploit it. So let me briefly mention two and then really drive in on one, which I think at the moment seems the most promising way we have of searching for this. So firstly, I mean, the axion is very light, but as far as we can tell, it should be heavier than the photon, okay? So if you have an interaction like this here, well, then this will actually allow the axion to decay, because it's an interaction vertex to a lighter state. And so this will allow axion decay of the form axion to two photons. And so we talked about this earlier on when we were looking at, say, sterile neutrinos, for example, where you could look for a photon line at half the mass. You can have the exact same situation here. If the axion is dark matter, it could be decaying and giving you a line at half the photon mass. So it's not an extremely difficult calculation to take this and determine what is the decay rate for that and what is the lifetime associated with it. But we can actually roughly guess how it's going to go. Okay, so here's the decay rate. Well, we know that this is quantum mechanics, so this g that enters will enter in the amplitude, and then we're going to have to square it to get the decay rate. So we're going to have g squared. But remember I told you g has inverse mass dimension. So this quantity has mass dimension minus 2, whereas the decay rate has mass dimension 1. So I'm missing 3 powers of mass, and the only thing that can make that up in this is going to be the axion mass, for example. So what you find for this is that at large axion mass, this decay rate is much more important than small axion mass. And then it's just a matter of putting the numbers in. And what you find, for example, is that if the axion had a mass of order a keV, like what we're talking about for these sterile neutrinos, it would actually decay rapidly enough that we definitely could observe it. But if you go and run this down to 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 9, 10 to the minus 12, this decay rate is completely negligible. It just so happens that it works out. So this is something you might have worried about. This could have killed this off as a dark matter candidate immediately, because maybe it would make it decay in the lifetime of the universe. But when you put in the numbers, it does not. So you can check, but people talk about keV mass axions, and actually one of the ways that they search for it is through this interaction here. So as per usual, I might just leave that board up there. Let's go. So let me turn now to the next type of way you could exploit this interaction, and this one actually does matter a little bit for the E dot B. And so the intuition here is that if we have this axion dark matter, or if we have, I don't know, for example, some axions produced and they're propagating through the universe, what if they pass through some region where we have a large amount of magnetic field? So if we have some background value for this and the axion's propagating through this, what we're left with is what looks like a mixing vertex. Essentially, just if I pin this to a background value, this is just looks like it's going to mix the axion into the photon and potentially vice versa. So that's the intuition. You can sit down and compute it and find out that exactly such an interaction is allowed, and there's a broad program of searching for axion photon mixing. And so in particular, where this E dot B interaction matters is if you know what direction your magnetic field is pointing, you know what polarization of the light you will produce out of this, for example. I mean, it has to be parallel to the magnetic field here, which is something that people exploit in the various some of the searches that they're doing. But at least in terms of the parametrics, it's not something I'm going to keep track of. So because this is a mixing effect, it's happening linearly in the amplitude. So what I expect is that this will be proportional to this coupling G here. I mean, this whole effect turns off if G goes to zero, so that has to appear. The other thing is it has to be dependent upon this background field. So I'll put the magnetic field in here. And now you know that magnetic field in natural units has mass dimension 2. This has mass dimension minus 1. A probability is just a number. So I need some other scale to put into this. And it turns out the way that we have to make this up, I mean, you can find this from the calculation, but you could have guessed this, is it has to be some length scale associated with over which this this mixing is occurring that you put into this. And so what exactly this length scale is, it's maybe how large the magnetic field exists over, but that's not the only possibility. For instance, we know, I mean, one of the things that you might be worried about here is that I'm trying to mix a state that has a mass into a state that doesn't have a mass. Okay, so at some level there can be there's a clear momentum mismatch there, but you can imagine that if the scale over which I'm doing that mixing is much smaller than the length scale associated with the mass of the axion, there's no way that this thing could have ever known that the axion mass was relevant. It's essentially an irrelevant parameter that's dropped out. But in some other limit, where if say the length scale associated with the axion mass is much smaller than the length scale of the magnetic field here, what it turns out in the calculation is you have to put that scale into here. So, I mean, I've put a generic length scale in, but depending on the problem, you have to be more careful about what you actually put in, or you can just do the detailed calculation. But nonetheless, broadly, people have been looking for the possibility that axions could convert into photons. One way that you might have heard of is that there's this famous CAST experiment at CERN, which was only decommissioned, I think, last year. And what they did is they took one of the leftover LHC dipole magnets, and they pointed it at the sun. So if the axion has this interaction FF tilde, we actually think, because there's a lot of photons in the sun, that the sun should be radiating some number of axions out of it. It turns out most of those are being radiated from the core of the sun, so they're coming out at energies of about keV. If you point a dipole magnet at the sun, some of those axions coming out of the core of the sun fly into your instrument, convert into keV photons or X-rays, and you can try and detect that at the other end. They did this for several decades. I mean, you would have heard about it if they'd seen something, so they didn't. And so their null observation tell us that broadly, the axion coupling has to be of this magnitude here. But no, this has nothing to do with dark matter. This is just if this axion exists in the spectrum of nature, it could be produced in the sun, and then it could be detected on Earth. And so this is sort of a generic bound. There's certainly some caveats on that, but this is quite a generic bound that one has that certainly dark matter axions have to satisfy. But it's going to be, actually, when you put in the numbers that you have for dark matter axions, often they'll be at a coupling strength that's much smaller than this. But this is a bound we have nonetheless. Please.
So did CAST look for only axion photomixing or also for axion decay?
Oh, good. CAST was just looking for... So, CAST would not be able to see axion decay for the following reason. It's a very odd telescope. So if you go into this room, they're pointing this LHC dipole magnet at the sun. So they follow the path of the sun throughout the day, but inside a building, okay? So if the axions were decaying at X, even though there's X-ray optics in this machine, the X-rays, well, one, they don't penetrate the atmosphere of the Earth, but two, they certainly wouldn't penetrate the building where this thing is pointing at. What you're relying on is the axion will fly through the atmosphere, it will fly through the building that you've constructed, and it will only convert into something detectable inside the LHC dipole magnet. And then within that, at the end of that optics, you have some X-ray detector that you're trying to search for. So they wouldn't see this, even though they have X-ray optics, for example. The reason you want to do this is that the sky's very bright in X-ray, so you want to get rid of the background, and that's the way that they do this. Good, but there are other ways of searching for this, like using X-ray telescopes, for example. So this is another way of searching for this, which has, in principle, nothing to do with dark matter. And the last one I want to focus on is really the case where it has something to do with dark matter. And this is going back to what we talked about earlier on, that you can think of this wave like dark matter as acting like a classical wave at the location of the Earth. Let me leave that here. And the intuition here is that if this is behaving like some classical field, if I have such an interaction here, you can imagine, I mean, this coupling strength is going to be extremely small, but this will give some modification to the classical laws we have of electromagnetism. And those are famously Maxwell's equations. So axions are going to modify Maxwell's equations by some effects that are proportional to this extremely small g that we have here. So how do we determine this? Well, what we want to do is just work out the classical equations of motion. I already gave some rough arguments about why you should roughly think of this as a classical field. And if that's the case, you should probably be able to explain what's going on with the classical equations of motion. So that's what we want to figure out. Okay. So in the metric convention I'm using here, I can write my Lagrangian in the following way. So the first two terms are just what you have for electromagnetism, and the last ones are what the axion adds in. And so what I mean by J here is just some physical currents and charges that we've set up, for example, to generate some fields in the lab. So what I want to do is take this here and just compute what are the equations of motion I have associated with this. So there are two objects we're going to want to compute the equations of motion of. Of course, because we want to rederive Maxwell's equations, we'll want to rederive the equations of motion associated with the vector associated with that, so a mu. But we'll also want to compute the equations of motion associated with the axion in principle to keep track of what's happening there. So let me do the axion case first, because this is particularly simple. We know what the kinetic term and the mass term is going to give us. And then what this is going to be modified by is that there's this final term there, the GFF tilde, which is going to act as a source term for axions. And you can sit down and compute it. It's maybe not immediately obvious ahead of time, but for everything we're doing in the mass, in the lab, for the sorts of fields that we can build and for the sorts of axion masses that we're checking, this term, which would act as a source for the axions, is completely negligible. So in some senses, we're going to be building a device that is trying to look for some effect associated with the axion, but we're not going to be able to back react on it. This way, we're just going to pull some tiny amount of energy out of this system and essentially leave it unperturbed. But in principle, this effect is there. And if you imagine if you go to, say, some of the strongest fields that we have in the universe, like around neutron stars, you can actually source axions using this interaction here. You just need to get to very, very large fields, which we can't achieve on the surface of the Earth. So that means that this, I mean, we know the solution to this is just acting like this oscillating cosine we talked about earlier on. So if there's going to be anything interesting that we can do, this was a pessimistic start, but we'll push on. We want to compute the equation of motion associated with the photon field. So what you need to remember how to do is how to do the variation with respect to F squared. I mean, it's a little bit fiddly, but you've probably done that before. And then it turns out that there's a very similar result when you do the variation with respect to FF tilde. I'm happy to write this out if anyone's interested, but otherwise, just to tell you what you get. So So what we find is the term, the normal inhomogeneous equations you get for Maxwell's equations in covariant form. So this is, the again, the current here. But now we have an additional contribution that we've added in, which is non-zero when G is non-zero and in locations where you have the axion. Okay. So then let me leave some space. So of course, this, you've probably worked this through before, but just to remind you, or in case you haven't, I mean, this equation here gives rise to Gauss's law and the Gauss's electric law and the Ampere-Maxwell law. That's only two of the four Maxwell's equations. So there's another equation we need to get the remaining two. But this doesn't actually come as an equation of motion. Again, this may be very familiar to some of you. So just to state where this actually comes from. The field strength obeys the so-called Bianchi identity, is one way of getting this. And this is mu sigma. The usual caveats about my handwriting apply, so please ask if it's unclear. So what I mean here, you might see I've got square brackets around the indices here. This means I'm totally anti-symmetrizing them, or totally skewing them, making them totally skew, sorry. And what you can check is that because this, you can check that it satisfies this, and because of this, what you find that the derivative acting on the Hodge dual of the field strength is exactly zero. And I think it's maybe a useful exercise if you're interested in this to work through and just confirm that that's actually the case. So we do have a second equation here, but it has nothing to do with coming from an equation of motion. It's just some other basic consistency property that this field has to satisfy. So actually we can make use of this, and I left myself absolutely not enough space. Because this equation is here, we can actually, sorry, one second, I'll just finish this and then I'll come to your question. So if we expand this out, using the product rule, this is a constant, so the derivative is not going to do anything. The derivative could act on the axion, or it could act on f tilde. But if the axion acted on, if the derivative acted on f tilde, we know that it has to be zero because we can use this equation of motion here. So we can rewrite this. Sorry, this is terrible board practice, but here I am. It'll be g dA nu A f tilde nu nu. So the form that this is appearing in the classical equations of motion is a derivative interaction for the axion. Because it's a pseudo-Goldstone boson, we expected that this is how it had to come out, but it's sort of a detailed way when we actually work this out where this comes from. It actually requires this other equation for that to come through. Please.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the square bracket notation. Are you anti-symmetrizing just mu and sigma or mu, nu, and sigma?
I'm all three. So you have to write down all combinations of these, make them anti-symmetric under all of them, and that has to be equal to zero here, is what I've said.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
No, please. Yeah, so if it was two indices, it's very straightforward, but for three, you have to work through all the different permutations. Good. So this is what we've got in terms of the covariant form of Maxwell's equations, but maybe it's slightly more intuitive to write these down in terms of electric and magnetic fields. So let me do that next. So to remind you, I had to remind myself, where are the fields hiding in here? So the electric field is in the zero I component of the field strength. And the magnetic field is in the purely spatial parts. So where this is the Levi-Civita symbol. But then this isn't enough to actually get all of Maxwell's equations. We need to know what is the, where are the equivalent quantities hiding in the dual field strength. And their locations are exactly flipped up to a minus sign. Okay, so with these two relations here, we can combine it with the two equations we had to derive what are the Maxwell's equations we're going to get. Just to give you a flavor of how you do this. let's take, I mean, this is the more interesting equation here. So let me take that and I'll take, let me call this x. And set mu to zero. If I set mu to zero, what I'm going to pull out of here is just the charge density. So I imagine hopefully what I'm going to get out of this is Gauss's law, but potentially with some correction. D nu. So firstly, I've set mu to zero, but I've still got this contraction here. But this is anti-symmetric, so the component where nu is zero isn't going to give any contribution. So I just have the spatial part. That's di f naught I. And then f naught I is exactly minus the electric field. And then this is just going to be the divergence of that. So this is equal to minus grad dot E. And then we just have to deal with the right-hand side of this. As I said, is minus J naught, and that'll be the charge density, plus G D nu A. Okay, so again, I've set mu to be zero. And now I need to look up what is F tilde. This will again have to be the spatial part. Nu naught is going to be a magnetic field here. And so what this is this will be minus rho, but if I put this all together and put the minus sign through, I'll get grad E equals rho. Good, we can rederive Maxwell's equations. But then we've got a new term here. Grad A. Okay? So there's an additional contribution which says that an axion, the gradient of an axion combined with some magnetic field we might have put in the lab will act like some oscillating charge density, is what we've got out of this. Okay? So you can imagine one can repeat this three more times to get all of Maxwell's equations. It all goes through roughly the same way, so let me just tell you what you get at the other end. Two of them we know are going to be exactly the usual homogeneous Maxwell's equations because we haven't changed that at all. So it's the remaining action is going to be in the Ampere-Maxwell law. So firstly, we'll get the gradient of B is zero. The curl of E, Faraday's law. Okay, and then the one that's a bit more interesting where this is the current now, the physical three current. And then we'll actually get two additional contributions in this case here. We'll get one that is related to a time derivative of the axion, and we'll get another which is dependent upon an electric field as well. Good, so what we have found is if I take G to zero, first consistency check, I get back Maxwell's equations. So that shows that I didn't drop any obvious signs. And the other thing you can see is what this looks like at the top. So B dotted into the gradient of A, that's a scalar quantity. So again, the axion source is what looks like some oscillating charge. Whereas down here, these are all vector quantities, note. So essentially what the axion induces is something that looks by analogy a little bit like a current, okay? And so what you can imagine doing is that the axion is either going to source very small charges, very small currents. We know what these things do thanks to Maxwell's equations or our understanding of electromagnetism. We try and search for these in a lab. However, I mean, we've got three modifications here. You can see they come in two characteristics forms. One of them comes in with a time derivative, and the other one comes in with a spatial derivative. Does anyone know, I mean, which one of these is probably going to be the more interesting to look at? I know some of you work on this, so I hope you would know the answer, but. Any thoughts on that? Sorry, just a pause. I know we've been going through a bit of math for the last 15 minutes. All right, let's estimate this.
There was someone
recently. Oh, I'm sorry. No, I missed you. Please. Yeah. You're too close. No. Go. No, please go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. So because we're able to better measure and create magnetic fields, the time derivative
You mean this one over that for that reason? Absolutely, yeah. That is the first observation. But then there's another one. We've now got two terms with the magnetic field. Which of those should we focus on? You're absolutely right. So, yeah, let's just ignore this. I mean, it's not negligible, right? It's only down by three orders of magnitude. But we're already looking for an extremely small effect. Let's keep track of every three orders of magnitude we can, right? So what about so let's estimate these, right? So what is this? Well, we're now imagining that this is dark matter. So what I'm going to pull out of this, from this field, is the momentum of this state, right? Times A, roughly. There'll be sines, yada, yada. And then let's compare this to the time derivative. What do I pull out if I just take a time derivative of this cosine that I'm thinking about for the axion?
Mass.
Just the mass, exactly. So this will just be MAA. So these differ by a V, and because this is non-relativistic, this is much, much smaller than the time derivative, right? Just, we know that in natural units, the time derivative, the velocity is about 10 to the minus 3. So actually both of, this effect is down by about 10 to the minus 6 compared to this, if you think of what you can do, whereas that one up there is down by 10 to the minus 3 with respect to this one. So this means that when people are trying to discover the axion, to give us every advantage that we can, we focus on this interaction here. Because it's going to have, one second, because it's going to have the be parametrically larger than the other two terms there. And so this tells us that what we want, I mean, we already thought we would want this, but this tells us at the level of the equations, we do want a magnetic field. And then what we're going to be focusing on is that this magnetic field combined with an axion gives rise to something that by analogy looks like a current. And we want to try and exploit this. Please, there was a question.
So are these estimates sensible enough to maybe look also for magnetic monopoles? Like if you look at monopoles, can you have some big modification of these estimates?
So with generically what magnetic monopoles do, right, is they modify the homogeneous equations. So if you had this in, it's going to be somewhat orthogonal to what you're doing here. They're going to impact the other equations that we're not comparing here. So people have looked down, I mean, there can be some interesting interplay between axions and magnetic monopoles, but generically, that I would quantify that as BSM squared, right? So which is usually famously harder to find than BSM, I think, but it is possible and people discuss it. So maybe just, I appreciate it, this was slightly involved. Maybe just to say, if you want to get, to make sure you really understand what's going on here, I can just give you a quick exercise. So here we focused on a pseudo-scalar coupling, but in principle there might be some fundamental scalar in nature that might modify this. So just repeat it if you actually had a scalar. So instead of an axion, I'll put a scalar, and instead of F tilde, it will couple to F squared, okay? So you can go through and figure out what is the equivalent. Again, you should only modify the inhomogeneous equations. You can figure out what you're going to get from this. And you'll actually find for this scalar case here, contributions that you did not find for the axion. There'll be the similar sorts of forms plus more. And I think understanding why the scalar gives you more contributions than the axion is an interesting question to think about that I'm happy to discuss. Good, so in the last, I appreciate I rushed through some things, but I'm very happy that I've made it to the last part, because now we've got the ingredients of what you actually want to detect this thing in the lab, okay? You need, the first key ingredient you need is the axion have to be dark matter. I mean, otherwise you're not going to see anything. This thing better be non-zero. Also, G better be non-zero. I mean, in many models it is non-zero, but, you know, nature may not be kind. And then the other thing from an experimental point of view is you need to build a large magnetic field to take advantage of this. And then what we see from this equation is that the combination of an axion and a magnetic field behaves like a current. So then there are many, many ways you can exploit this. I mean, at this stage, probably order 50 experiments people are talking about to try and exploit this in different ways. And usually they all have some catchy name. But let me just run you through one experiment that I've worked with, because I have some intuition for this. And I think it's a very simple way of seeing what you can do to search for this.
Oh, that could be, sorry.
No, please, yeah.
That behavior as a current, yeah, because you can have axion gamma coupled to a gamma.
Sure, yeah, I mean, there's many ways of thinking about it. I mean, we've added, I think this is sort of says a little bit to the richness of a lot of these things. So it's just one small little term we've added to the Lagrangian of nature. But then there's many different experimental realizations of this. This particle is then forced to decay. It can mix into in the presence of magnetic fields throughout the universe, or it can start driving very, very small currents in the lab, for instance. And this is what I want to turn to now. So the thing you can control as an experimentalist is building a magnetic field. And we know how to build various magnetic fields. Let me just show you one example. This is the example that's exploited by the experiment Abracadabra, which you might have heard of. It's actually an acronym, if you can find it. It stands for a broadband resonant approach to cosmic axion detection with a B-ring apparatus, which is unbelievable. Okay. And the fact it works is very impressive. So the idea is, in this experiment, is you have some toroidal magnet that I'm viewing from below, but there's a I'm viewing from above or below, but there's a third dimension to this. And so you have a toroidal field that's wrapping around here. So that's what you've built. But again, I mean, this isn't enough to win the Nobel Prize. You need a second ingredient here. And that is that you actually need the dark matter to be an axion. And then the claim, I mean, at the level of the equations, is that the interaction between this dark matter wind or this dark matter wave and this magnetic field is that you'll source a current. But if you look at the equation here, the current, this dTA is just a scalar. So the current is going to be directly proportional to the magnetic field that you've generated there, right? And so what you can see is that the current that you induce will also be toroidal. However, the sign of it will be oscillating because it's proportional to the axion field, which is oscillating upwards and down. So this thing will, there'll be some current that's toroidal, but it's oscillating backwards and forwards in time. So what? Well, if you remember your right-hand rule, I mean, there's a lot that you can remember from electromagnetism, but that's a helpful one. You'll find that this current will be inducing a magnetic field in the center. And why that's interesting is because if you've built your magnetic, your toroidal magnetic field well enough, there should be no magnetic field in here. So if you can go and then try and detect, this system will have an oscillating magnetic field in the center of this toroid that wouldn't be there if there wasn't an axion, you know, up to the various backgrounds you could get. So let's try and estimate how large this will be. So we're inducing some axion magnetic field. I'm just going to do this parametrically, but I promise you I'm not lying to you too much. You can check afterwards. So the size of this effect that we get, it's going to be linear in G because that's the proportional to the term that we're putting in here. So we've got this G. And it also will go away if we turn off the background field. So it has to have the magnitude of this background field we put in. Then it will be related to a time derivative of the axion. And then let's check the dimensions here. So this has the same dimensions of this. So this is minus 1. Plus 1, plus 1, so it's 1, so I need to subtract 1 mass dimension off, and shock horror, the size of the system is going to matter. The larger the volume over which I do this, the bigger effect I'm going to be able to generate. So this is what makes this up. It's roughly the size of the experiment, but if you put in actually do the calculations, you'll find what specific scales enter. So let's estimate this. So to do so, let me set G to be the cast value. So this is the largest this could possibly be. So I told you that we still got that on the board. Excellent, I rubbed that out. 6.6 by 10 to the minus 11 GeV inverse is the units that I gave for that. The other thing, what's the other value I put in here? The other quantity I'm going to need for this is a rough value of dA. So remember, this is going to pull out a mass. And I told you previously that the amplitude of the axion field is 2 times the square root of 2 times the local dark matter density divided by the mass. So these factors cancel. And it's roughly the square root of the dark matter density. You know how to convert between EV and centimeters, or at least Mathematica does. And you can find that this is 2 by 10 to the minus EV squared. 10 to the minus 3 EV squared is what you can check. And then look, we want to make L as large as we possibly can, but again, there's physical constraints and budgetary constraints, and so we're probably not going to be able to get larger than about a meter. We hope to eventually get to 10 meters, but let's start at something like a meter, and that is roughly 5 by 10 to the 6 EV inverse. Good, so we want B0 to be as big as possible, but we can't get larger than about 10 Tesla, so let's just estimate how large this is going to be, putting all these numbers in. So at the cast value, I'm putting in G first, 10 to the minus 20 EV inverse. Then I'm putting in the value of DA, which is this two by 10 to the minus 3 EV squared. And then I'll put in the length. That's 5 by 10 to the 6 EV inverse. And then I'm going to times this by 10 Tesla, but I don't need to...
The G from cast 10 to the minus 20, I think it was...
It was 10 to the minus 11 GV inverse, and I've... No, thank you. And then I swapped that to EV inverse to make these all consistent. These are the units people usually quote this in, GV inverse. Good. And I've left this in Tesla because I want to know what BA is in Tesla. But you can check minus 1 plus 2 is 1, minus 1 is 0. The other units are going to cancel. Let me just finish this and I'll come to you. So what we find from this... is about 10 to the minus 15 Tesla at the most optimistic value of the coupling. And yeah, I can tell you that's much smaller than B0. So sure, you have some handle, like it's in a region where you wouldn't see it otherwise, but at most, this is going to be an extremely small magnetic field that you're inducing in this. So that gives you some flavor about why we haven't seen it so far, but experimentalists are incredible and they believe that this, I mean, even values smaller than this are achievable. And so this is broadly how people are trying to tackle this. Please, there was a question, yeah.
I expected the mass of the axion also enter this calculation. It's because the mass controls the wavelengths and its oscillation somehow should depend on the wavelengths.
Good, no, that's... that's interesting, but it's not... I mean, if you think about it... So, I mean, in this particular experiment, I can tell you why it doesn't matter, essentially. Because for these instruments, for this effect to work, I need to work in a limit where the spatial scale of the oscillations are much larger than the instrument. If they are not, let's say that I've not drawn this to scale. The actual wavelength needs to be much larger so that the effect is coherent over the instrument. If it is not, then a part over here won't be phase coherent with a part over here, and you'll start to get destructive interference between the sources that are impacted in the middle. So for this particular experiment, it actually works much better than when the wavelength is much larger than this. So in that case, you would expect I'm in a limit where it could drop out. But more generally, the nature of these derivative interactions is, at least in terms of the... If you look at the detailed response, the mass is 100% there. It's controlling the frequency of the oscillations that you see. So the mass enters in a very fundamental way there in terms of how you'd look for it. But in terms of setting the magnitude of the effects, it does not enter. And I mean, the way of seeing this is that this thing's a Goldstone boson. So all of the effects we're looking for are related to the derivative acting on that field. That derivative will always pull out a mass, which will always lead to... I mean, this cancellation isn't just unique to the calculation I did here. In terms of the overall amplitude of the effects, this mass is always going to drop out. I mean, if it came in linearly, it would be somewhat of a disaster, because we already know for the theories we're looking at, G is dropping off with a function of mass, right? So it is somewhat there. If you paid another price here, say it came in linearly, you'd be losing as mass squared, but you only usually lose as one power of mass. There's more questions, please.
Yeah, we got this estimate from these modified Maxwell equations over there, and there's also the curl of the magnetic field in there. We should have some curl of the magnetic field, right?
So
much smaller.
Do you mean like in Faraday? On the left-hand side here. No, this is good. So what, ultimately what you need to do is work through these calculations in detail to see what's going on. But just to tell you what you should think of, this effect here is acting just like another current, okay? And then we know what currents do because, you know, our intuition for things like the right-hand rule come through the classical Maxwell's equation. So this axion just acts like another current, but then through the classical through our intuition for classical Maxwell's equations, these effects are incorporated in there. So you're right, of course that must enter, it's important, but that's actually wrapped up in the use of the right-hand rule. Yeah. Good. Please, there was another question.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that to the previous question. I've seen some experiments that work the magnitude of the magnetic field by using the spatial component of the axial wind, and it does scale to the mass, but it's like 10 to the minus 20 Tesla.
Good. So the first part of your statement, the only place where you have both a magnetic field and a spatial gradient is in the Gauss's law. And then it's not behaving like a current, it's behaving like an oscillating charge. So that's one effect you can look for. And in this case, though, what charges, at least not, initially what we think of as generating, is that they generate electric fields, right? So that would be something that you would be looking for there. So I'm not particularly, do you know off the top of your head the name of the experiment that does this?
Like an NMR machine.
Ah, but good, if it's NMR, this is looking for not the electric coupling. Yeah, exactly. So this is something completely different. This is looking for either this oscillating neutron EDM, this is Casper, or it's looking for some quark couplings, because quarks will also couple to neutrons. This is, I mean, the question that is being asked here is that not only is there order 50 experiments looking for GA gamma gamma, the axion could couple many other ways, and there are other experiments. I'm very happy to talk about those offline, but I'm barely getting through the one experiment that I wanted to say here. So I've got about 5 minutes left. So the last thing, maybe I'll just say some of this qualitatively, but let me leave you with one exercise based on this that I thought was kind of interesting. So if you look at this thing here, let me call this plus. So check that plus transforms consistently under parity. The reason this is maybe a little bit surprising is that this magnetic field is a pseudo-vector, this is a pseudo-vector, this is a pseudo-scalar. So naively, there's a bit of a mismatch here, but if you actually think through the vectors that are going on here, you can check that this is consistent, but it's not immediately trivial, so it's worth checking. However, then you can try and do this same parametric argument if, again, you swap this with a scalar. So of course one can do the calculation, but once you've resolved how all of this works for the parity of a pseudoscalar axion, if you then swap this to a scalar, something's got to give, something's got to change again. So try and figure that one out. So I think that's sort of a cute way of understanding what's going on here. So what I wanted to go through at the end is just some, but I won't have time, so I'll just leave it here and tell you roughly what I wanted to cover, was actually how do you then analyze what you're getting out of this, right? So you have some oscillating magnetic field in the center of this toroid where ideally there should be nothing else. What you can imagine doing is putting some loop of a wire in the middle here. That oscillating magnetic flux will induce an oscillating current in that wire that we're actually quite good at measuring currents, and you can try and read that out. And in particular, what you're going to be looking for is an oscillation frequency that is peaked at a very particular frequency, and that's the unknown mass of the axion. So one of the real challenges with these searches is it's a tiny, tiny, tiny effect at an unknown frequency, which potentially could exist over many, many orders of magnitude. So this is really the experimental challenge, is how can you efficiently cover in a human lifetime a large fraction of that mass range? And often what one needs to do is to think, well, in all of these experiments, you really need to think about this problem in the frequency domain. I mean, we're used to, I think, working in the time domain, but when you're working with these sorts of oscillating frequencies, this is the most natural way of describing this. And I would say, at least for myself, coming from a particle physics background, I have much more intuition for particles coming and scattering off things than I do for working in the frequency domain. But nonetheless, this is what you have to do when you're describing wave-like dark matter. So I've got like 2 minutes left. So just to sum up what we've covered in this, and then I can leave some time for questions. I've just given you the absolute surface of what you can do to try and search for these wave-like effects. But broadly, what happens in these types of searches is you can't back-react generically on the wave that's here. You can't do any perturb it. It seems to be essentially just fixed there. What you can do is pull some tiny amount of energy out of it by having it drive some effect in an experiment you're searching for. Now that effect is going to depend on what you've coupled to. Here, because it's experimentally the easiest, essentially, I focus on the coupling to electromagnetism. So we build some electromagnetic field. The coupling between it and the axion will drive some tiny, tiny response that experimentalists are amazing enough that they could actually measure this. But then broadly, maybe the axion couples to quarks. If it couples to quarks, it will couple to nucleons. And then if you build, I mean, as was alluded to, if you have something like an NMR experiment, the axion could be inducing some little oscillating effect in these nucleons. You could try and search that out. But broadly, we're looking for, at a set frequency, some tiny, tiny effect induced in this. And this is now what a huge fraction of the dark matter community is thinking about. But stepping back, although I hope that this is what dark matter could be, because if it is, we're building the experiments that could find it in the next decade or so, I could be wrong. And there's every possibility that what dark matter is actually something else within this parameter space that we're just not thinking about at the moment. So although I think it's very interesting to do deep dives in this, and it's very worthwhile searching this out, please don't take away from these lectures that, I mean, we're going to find the axion in the next 5 years. It could be something that we haven't thought of yet. And I think that the fact that dark matter could be there more broadly is... just a very interesting problem to think on. Okay, so I'll leave it there. And again, I want to thank you all for extremely interactive lectures. I really appreciate all of the questions. And I'm around for the next half an hour at the coffee break, so I'm happy to answer any more then if there are them. Okay, thank you, everyone.
Scenarios where we can measure axions. Like, what if we consider lasers, gamma ray bursts, and see, I was thinking of two kinds of things. First, you have, for example, proton accelerating. They can interact with gamma CMB, and you have like proton, proton, gamma, and then, they can be just proton, proton, gamma, and then you have a gamma and an axion. So you have an effect there. And the other thing, the effect I was really thinking of was gammas with CMB gammas.
Yeah, just as, go ahead.
Redistribute like photons because they can interact through axions. Can we see some effects?
100%, this is the effect you're talking about, like this one here, for instance. Like there's some fermion, you said a proton, and then this interaction I gave you will give rise to, essentially, this is one manifestation of axion-photon conversions, which you can see. And for example, this is one of the dominant production mechanisms for the axion in the sun that CAST makes use of. But broadly, like for example, you talked about very energetic emission mechanisms like the like blazars or GRBs, for example. So you absolutely can search for this. And the way that you search for it is these objects emit extremely high energy photons, like even order up to PeV or higher, extremely high energy photons. And we actually know through the interaction of those states with the CMB that none of them should reach the Earth, essentially. The universe essentially becomes opaque to photons above about 100 TeV because they can pair create to an E plus E minus pair off the CMB. You can check that's when you roughly have the right center of mass energy. And so this would then reprocess the energy to lower values and you'd never see anything. But there is a large program of trying to search for higher energy photons in the case where you have axions. Because there, what can happen is, in the ambient magnetic fields of the universe, this extremely high energy photon can convert to an axion, propagate most of the distance so it never pair creates, and then propagate in our own Milky Way, convert back to a PeV photon again, and then you might see it. So there are actually searches using exactly this. You might have heard there was recently this extremely energetic GRB. There was a statement that LASO, this very high energy observatory in Western China, had seen some very high energy photons, and there was order 50 papers claiming that could be associated with an axion. So many people are thinking about this. Exactly, yeah. Please.
If I, for a moment, put aside all the observational constraints that we have for axion and assume its mass can go arbitrarily small.
Yes, yeah.
To explain dark energy.
So, good. Just something else that I mentioned it several times in the lectures, and I just want to emphasize more because it touches on what you said. So we know that just from the observation of the existence of galaxies that dark matter can't be lighter than about 10 to the minus 21 EV, and people debate about exactly what that is. But again, axions are well enough motivated that you might imagine that they exist even if they're not the dark matter. And so you could have some fraction of these axions being slightly lighter than that. And actually people look for observable, because then you would, if say it was like some 10% of dark matter, or I don't even think that's allowed, like a percent of dark matter, you might have some massive halo that's much larger than the galaxies collapse around these things. And there's actually a broad observational program looking for that possibility. But the idea that some sort of scalar could be associated with dark energy, I believe, is one that is very well investigated. I'm not an expert on this. I think other members of the audience are. I think ideas like quintessence and things like this are related to that. But broadly, observationally at the moment, I don't think we see any evidence that there is, you know, non-trivial dynamics in dark energy, that it's beyond a essentially just a cosmological constant. And the hope is, with the upcoming, cosmological observation programs, we might see some deviation from this. And I'm not up to date, but I imagine that some of these models that people have, where it is like some ultralight scalar, would be able to explain some of the some deviations from a constant if you had them. But other members of the audience know a lot more about this than me. So it's a possibility people discuss, but yeah.
I was asking, theoretically, if a very, very light axion can behave like a constant? Or...
Well, we've already seen in one regime where the axion will behave like a constant, right? This is when the Hubble scale is much larger than its mass. And at the moment, the Hubble scale is about 10 to the minus 31 eV. So for example, if you had an axion with a mass that is much lighter than 10 to the minus 31, you're still in this regime, for example, where it's trapped and it's still behaving like a constant. So yes, in that case there. But I've not given this any deep thought. Yeah. Okay, time for... sorry, please.
Is there any way to place an upper limit on the mass?
If it's dark matter, yes, there is. And the way that you can do this is these decay bounds. Remember, as I go to higher and higher masses, it decays more and more rapidly. At some mass, it just couldn't be dark matter. It would have decayed in a, much shorter than the age of the universe. But we can do better than that by looking for these X-rays, for example, that it could emit, or photons that it emits. And this tells us that it's also a function of the coupling, right? You can also turn the coupling down. But as you get above order an EV or so, these constraints start to become strong enough that people don't really talk about that as being dark matter. But there are caveats to that. People try and model build around this. If it's the QCD axion, there is definitely a problem, because as you make it heavier and heavier and heavier, the interaction strengths become stronger and stronger. And for example, from memory, the bound is that through this coupling that I've rubbed out to GG tilde, if the mass is above about a milli EV, you muck up observable properties of supernova 1987A, I believe. You would have emitted a lot of axions from that object, which would then have depleted the neutrinos you saw. And so the fact that we saw roughly the predicted number of neutrinos knows we couldn't have emitted a huge amount of axions. So that, if it's the QCD axion, it has to be lighter than about 10 to the minus 3 EV from that argument. But broadly, such arguments can be made. Also, I'm also happy to chat for indefinitely. I just want to make sure that people who have time to get coffee can get coffee at the same time. Yes, yeah. Okay, thank you, everyone.